Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, listeners. This is Dan Nexon. Today I'm talking to John Eikenberry about all things liberal international order. John Eikenberry is the Albert G. Milbank Professor of Politics and International Affairs at Princeton University in the Department of Politics and the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs. He's also the co-director of Princeton's Center for International Security Studies. John has a whole list of other accolades, which you can go read about on his website. He is the author of 8 books, including After Victory, Institutions, Strategic Restraint, and the Rebuilding of Order After Major Wars, which came out with Princeton in 2001, Liberal Leviathan, The Origins, Crisis, and Transformation of the American System, which came out in 2011, and most recently, A World Safe for Democracy, Liberal Internationalism, The Crisis of Global Order, which was published by Yale University Press in 2020. We're going to be primarily talking about arguments that John makes in A World Safe for Democracy, as well as some pieces that you may have read me talking about at the blog. Most notably, his piece on Rooseveltian foreign policy with Dan Dudney, which appeared this year in Foreign Policy. And I want to start by welcoming John to our program.
Thank you, Dan. It's great to be here.
So there's a lot we could talk about. I really would like to start, though, is if you could tell our listeners a bit about your most recent book, which I think is a really important backdrop for all the different contexts that they've been reading your name recently.
Yes, absolutely. The book that you're speaking of is the book that came out last fall, A World Safe for Democracy, which really is my effort to reconstruct and illuminate the liberal international tradition across the 200 years. And it really begins with the debate that everyone is having, the kind of crisis of the contemporary global order, the breakdown of the U.S.-led international order, a kind of general lost confidence in collective solutions to common problems, the kind of we can organize the world attitude of earlier generations has been lost, a kind of world historical moment that we seem to be in, where all different possible futures seem to be on the table for debate. As scholars, as IR scholars, we're asking first order questions again. We're asking, you know, what are the sources of international order? Can liberal democracy make a comeback? Can capitalism and liberal democracy be reconciled and rebalanced? And the question I really ask in the book is, what is the future of liberal internationalism as a tradition of order building, of the cooperative organization of the global system? So we're back to these basic questions. We're rereading Morgenthau and Carr and Polanyi. But in particular, I'm asking the question, of liberal internationalism, where it's taken its hits, it's been debated in with new skepticism. Where can liberal internationalists plant their flag? On what intellectual and geopolitical ground can they plant their flag? And my first move in the book is to take the long view, to argue that it's a longer story than many people believe. A liberal order didn't begin in 1989, or even for that matter, 1945. That it's a more contested, agonistic, in the sense of the Greek word agon for conflict, a more contested history. There are, yes, golden eras, but deep contestation, close-run moments. The 1930s and 40s were a very important time for me. I spent a lot of my time writing this book at Oxford, at All Souls, in the heart of the Trump period. And the 30s and early 40s seemed to be a really important moment to look back to see how liberal internationalists picked up the pieces there and reimagined both liberal democracy and liberal international order. And a book that really got me, Dan, really kept with me, was Ira Katznelson's Desolation and Enlightenment, a kind of look at those moments when everything falls apart and how do liberals and liberal internationalists reimagine their projects, the Great Depression, totalitarianism on the rise, fascism, total war, the experience of total war, the Holocaust, and then the dropping of the atomic bomb, all of this in one generation. And So looking at how liberal internationalism, and in particular in these moments where liberals and liberal internationalists seem to lose their way and then find their way again. So the book tries to do three things. It tries to make the case that liberal internationalism has a kind of deep intellectual history, a kind of gravitas that is worthy of sitting alongside its great rival realism as a way of thinking about and acting in the world, although different than realism. It's not simply either or, as I try to argue in the book. They're doing slightly different things, and realists and liberals can live together intellectually and politically in different ways. We may want to explore that. To show the failures and accomplishments of liberal internationalism, to acknowledge a sober, honest reflection on what works and what doesn't work, on failures, obviously in the shadow of the Iraq War, the shadow of the 2008 financial crisis, the shadow of the, you might say, the failure of the liberal bet to get China right. We may want to talk about that as well. So, but also to make the case, when I think my first book talk might have been Gideon Rockman of the Financial Times said that liberal internationalism is often portrayed as a kind of form of American, kind of global coercion or oppression. If it's more than that, the case needs to be remade, to restate what have been kind of failures, but not just failures, but successes, what has been accomplished in the face of critics from both the left and the right. And then thirdly, and this is where the kind of Rooseveltian kind of tradition reimagining and bringing it forward, where does liberal internationalism take us today? How can it be useful for 21st century problems of global politics? And this sense that it has another cycle of importance in how we think about organizing world order in this current era. I guess the substantive argument is that liberal internationalism is a tradition of traditions. It's got lots of different pieces in it, and I try to avoid what I call the no good Scotsman fallacy of defining liberal internationalism only in a way that fits my case or only makes it look good. That to acknowledge that it's messy. There are lots of different internal debates, broader debates. Of course, it's housed in a broader a tradition of debate across the liberal spectrum and beyond. There's the laissez-faire liberals and the social democratic liberals who fight it out in various ways in different moments in the progressive era and the New Deal period and in the 70s and today. There's the liberalism that's tied to empire and imperialism. There's the liberalism that's tied to hegemony and great power politics. There's the liberalism and liberal internationalism tied to global human rights. There's the liberal internationalism tied to a conception of liberal order as a Western club, and another vision of liberal internationalism as a universal system come who wants to the liberal gathering. What I would say is what is the taproot? What is the idea that is in the essence? And here I do go back to Wilson and the most famous phrase that many people say is the single best distillation of liberal internationalism, to make the world safe for democracy. That's often read as a kind of a declaration of a kind of idealist crusade to spread liberal democracy worldwide, but that it can be read, and this is my first of what I hope you might recognize as many kind of moves in the book to orient my account, that it's better seen as more literally as a project to make safe liberal democracy. And that, in some sense, the essential goal is creating a space, an ecosystem. And I know you, Dan, have used that term, and I share your interest in deploying on a sense of space, a kind of complex organized space in which liberal democracies and other states are occupy and use that space, if it's well organized, to do various things, and things that liberal democracies need to do in particular: manage their own interdependence, to manage their vulnerabilities, to balance what liberal democracies create as a kind of constitutional tension at the heart of what we call liberal democracy, the tension between principles, between liberty and equality, between individualism and community, between openness and social solidarity, between sovereignty and interdependence. To be in a liberal democracy, to be defending liberal democracy, you are in a never-ending debate with yourself and others about how to balance all these principles that are in some fundamental sense not capable of full reconciliation. The convictions behind liberal internationalism, trade and openness is good, properly managed, that rules and institutions matter. They can facilitate cooperation for reasons that IR theorists debate. That democracies do have a special capacity to work together. They have been on the same side of the great conflicts. They do have capacities to overcome security dilemmas and other sources of obstacles to cooperation. They have shared values they want to preserve. And then finally, and this is what I really, in again, another move in the book, I try to make the case that liberal internationalism is distinctive among the great ideologies, the great theories of international order, in that it puts at the center of its DNA the management of interdependence. That in a world of rising economic security and environmental interdependence, cooperation is at the heart of the kind of solution set for managing interdependence. That if we don't hang together, we will hang separately. That the costs of lost autonomy associated with making binding commitments is less than the gains accrued from coordinating policies across political space. And so this is kind of the view. Now, one or two more kind of portrait characteristics of liberal internationalism. One of the arguments I make in the book is that liberal internationalism is kind of paradoxical in that it's very intellectually capacious. It sees itself as having something to say about the entire world, about the globe, about modernity, about the direction of history, about how societies are moving across time and space. So in that sense, very much kind of the world is its intellectual oyster. But on the other hand, it's politically very thin. It's not a political movement. I've looked at 200 years of liberal internationalism, and there aren't, it's an army without, it's a flag without an army. It's not capable of moving the world under its own terms, that it's always has needed to tie itself to other projects. And this is important in my response to both critics on the right and the left who see liberal internationalism as very much implicated in lots of geopolitical and world historical crime scenes in the 19th and 20th century. It's been involved in interventions, and it's either been a complicitous, or it's been it's stood by and not prevented lots of bad things happening in the world. Obviously, empire, racial hierarchy. It is deeply entangled in these other great forces. I would say the great forces that it's entangled in are empire and imperialism, geopolitical rivalries, hegemonic projects, global capitalism, and Anglo-American efforts to organize the world. But it's also complicitous in the great, probably underappreciated movement of the globalized world in our modern era, which is the move from empire to nation state. It's been on both sides of that struggle, how to organize the world by empire or by nation state. But in the end, it plunked down in favor of the nation state. And you see this in the Roosevelt period after World War II. And what I try to do in the book in little moments is look for those cracks in the facade of liberalism and its kind of complicity with these other forces, to find ways in which the liberal states, the U.S. and others, have seen their interests and their values pushed forward by pushing back on empire and beginning to imagine a kind of a moral vision of the world that is post-imperial. The other kind of final point, Dan, I'll just make in terms of the portrait, which sets up kind of some of the discussion of neoliberalism and the current period, is that a move that I make in the book is to think about liberal internationalism as a bundle of internationalisms that kind of have come together and braided into projects at different moments, then unbraided and been reconnected in various ways at later periods. The 19th century is liberal internationalism is really manifest in all these different types of slightly independent internationalism, legal internationalism of jurists, free trade, obviously, of the post-Corn Law period, the arbitration movement, the peace movement, the interparliamentary unions and their movements. In the 19th century, between the end of the Napoleonic War and the beginning of World War I, there were 1,000 conferences in Europe on how to bring internationalism to bear on Atlantic and global order. So the 19th century was alive, teeming with ideas about threads that could tie the world society together, and lots of agendas. Wilson kind of brought these ideas together. He wasn't a new visionary. He was more of a bundler giving voice. And of course, things fell apart. And then the Rooseveltian period was a rebundling with more social democratic agendas in the shadow of the Cold War. And then, in some sense, the current period, beginning in the 70s and 80s, the unraveling of that post-war coalition of social democracy, internationalism, Cold War liberalism, struggle for the world, kind of anti-communism, all these kind of features that shaped and shifted a liberal internationalism, it kind of became unbundled under unipolarity. And neoliberalism kind of became the default liberal internationalism, a kind of platform for bankers and capitalists to do deals. Where are workers in this? What about questions of social justice and the everyday people living everyday lives? What does liberal internationalism do for them? So that's where I really leave. I'll leave my portrait of the book. I hope that helps us kind of take us into some of these debates.
I'm going to ask you a question that's probably a little unfair, because given all that you've said, but is there an essence to liberal internationalism? You've talked about a lot of a constellation of things, and you've pointed out, I think, quite persuasively, correctly, that liberal internationalisms have looked very different in different times and different places. But is there something we can say is essential to liberal internationalism that makes it different from other types of internationalism or other types of ways of thinking about how international politics should be ordered?
No, that's not an unfair question. I think I've grappled with that every day in writing this book, and it's a coalition, really, and that's in some sense both its weakness and its strength. It's its strength in that it has this kind of shape-shifting quality. Different kinds of actors with different agendas can be part of it, but it also is its weakness in that it where is the essence? And of course, it legitimates both a kind of market society, even as it elevates a kind of emphasis, unlike other ideologies of individual rights and protections. It evolves as liberal democracy itself evolves. 19th century laissez-faire democracy, where the fruits of liberty and rights and protections were only partially shared inside of societies. The kind of evolution of that, the unfolding. One of the things that liberals and liberal internationalists buy into is this kind of unfolding quality. That, you know, think of the American project, the American experiment, you know, first in freedom, this kind of republic it included the original sin of slavery. And so part of the liberal experience and project is to build on what you've done and pass it on to the next generation, the sense of a work in progress, in both senses, the work in progress. And so that's kind of both important and I think constructive in seeing how you can link together and connect dots and see this liberal international experience. E.P. Thompson, in his History of the English Working Class, it sort of talks about, at any given moment or place, it's hard to see class, but if you kind of take a longer kind of almost a video view, you take a picture of history and move it across time and see the moving parts move, you can see it kind of come out of the background. And so too, I think, with liberal internationalism, when you kind of start the projector and you can see actors and you can see the 19th century Cobden, who's very much echoed in later generations by John Hobson in his period, those who came in the 20th century, of free traders and institution builders. So I do think there is a kind of core that has to do with openness, exchange, institutional embodiment of our mutual ecosystem space, the importance of managing the problems of modernity. There are, and you see this in the interwar liberals and liberal internationalists, who I was very keen to look at, because they kind of went through the Wilson euphoria to the Wilson nightmare into the period of Roosevelt, and trying to reimagine both liberal democracy, which had, as many people from E.H. Carr to Polanyi realized, as was gone, that the old world of liberalism and democracy had to be reimagined. And so there was a debate, and you had those who came along for the ride, social democrats, but lots in the post-war period, lots of, you know, think of the German German social conservatives, and those who didn't come along, the libertarians. Yeah. So there's always been a spectrum, and some have seen their vision enhanced by kind of amalgam of views, and others who have seen it's a kind of a see that the project is either unworthy of the vision, it's too prosaic, it's too status quo, it settles too easily. That might be a view from the left, and others who see it basically as a facade for power, or as we've said before, as a kind of excuse for kind of hubris and adventurism.
So one of the things that I think is quite interesting about all of this, and this is both there in your book and it's there in the Rooseveltian foreign policy piece that you did with Dan Dudney, is this disconnect. I don't really know what to call it, maybe a disconnect that you've picked up on and are playing around with and running with, which is that the history that we told of liberal internationalism for a very long time, the stylized story that you would get in your international relations textbooks, it's even there to some degree in After Victory, the sort of really big breakout book that you wrote that became the kind of go-to text for anti-Bush foreign policy thought in the early 2000s. Is the idea that, you know, we have the story that says, okay, well, Wilson comes along and he tries to do liberal internationalism. He pushes for the League of Nations and all these things that you can trace back to Kant's essays on perpetual peace and all that. He can't mobilize support in the United States, so the United States doesn't join. The U.S. takes a turn away from liberal internationalism. Again, this is the stylized story. Things go very badly in the interwar period. Oftentimes, the argument is that the lack of U.S. commitment explains a lot of the failures of liberal internationalism. And so Roosevelt, at the end of the Second World War, or towards the end of the Second World War, really re-picks up the torch. Yeah. And so Roosevelt realizes the initial impulse for liberal internationalism. This is a story we've often told. It's the story that I think you'd still find in textbooks in IR. It's a story that you disagree with. And I want to hear a little bit more about what's wrong with it. And then I want to come back to this idea about this disconnect.
Yeah, well, I think the first thing I'll say is that I do put in my book Wilson and Roosevelt as kind of, I use them, kind of anthropomorphize them as kind of archetypes of two different versions of liberal internationalism. And maybe I could just say that this is one of those moves in the book that I've always thought was kind of at the core of what I'm trying to do. Wilson, in many ways, was conceiving of the liberal international project at a moment when liberal democracy seemed to be on the move. Every country west of Russia after in 1920 was some kind of parliamentary system. There was a sense that in his own mind, but also among others around him and across the European and North America a sense that liberal democracy was on the march. And so in some sense, what Wilson was doing was leveraging that movement of liberal democracy to try to build a better international order. So in some sense, a liberal democracy was the glue that was going to hold the international order together. Whereas in Roosevelt's time, everything is the reverse of that. A liberal democracy is experiencing an extinction moment. It looks like it's not working. Other models, other modernity projects are in the offing. Germany was in various quarters in the United States and elsewhere, at least into the middle 30s, was seen as, you know, providing some kind of answers to the problem of the Great Depression and the kind of ravages of industrial society at that moment. So there was a sense of liberal democracy is really on the ropes, and that the international order that we need to build will provide, and this is why it's the reverse of the Wilson vision, it's international order that is the glue that will hold liberal democracies together. So, and this is, for me, an important reason why returning to the Rooseveltian conception is so important, because it really gets us to this view that constructing that ecosystem of states that are working to create a kind of higher level set of institutions and responsibilities and capacities and authority relationships, so that these fragile and vulnerable and conflicted and today polarized liberal democracies can lick their wounds and rebuild their institutions, kind of. So it's very much like Roosevelt. You think of Biden. You know, it reconstruct infrastructure. Infrastructure bill is something, but it's also a metaphor for building back the infrastructure of liberal democracy and the sinews of a working international order, problem solving, pragmatic. Roosevelt was, as Keynes wrote in what was a wonderful little piece in the, he published a letter in the New York Times in the late 30s, basically praising Roosevelt for his pragmatism and effort to kind of willingness to reimagine liberal democracy and industrial society for these much more difficult times. But it was very much a pragmatic, Roosevelt was not seized with a particular vision. It was more, you know, we're entering a period where we don't quite know what all the moving parts are. So we're going to kind of move here, see if this works. And if it does, we'll keep moving. If not, we'll step to the left. We'll turn around. We'll try something else. So a kind of stochastic exercise in problem solving and learning that you see throughout this period that seems to be that's the liberal internationalism that I think is what those who want to keep it, who want to redeploy it, who want to see that it has another cycle. It's that kind of world weary. Sort of more kind of a sober sense of global problem solving that is there that can be brought out and emphasized in the next period.
Yeah, the reason why I mentioned that there was an interesting disconnect here is that the IR story, which you're criticizing, is very different than the story that we've tended to tell, I think, in our field when we talk about domestic politics, right? Because there we tend to tell the Katznelson-Polanyi story, where there is the crisis of interwar liberalism, the challenges of fascism and Marxist-Leninism or Bolshevism, as Polanyi calls it, really kind of create a new way of doing liberalism, right? Lead to a reinvention of liberalism along a New Deal liberal model, or what we would, Sherry Berman would call a social democratic model, right? Becomes prominent as the liberal model. And so it's interesting to me that, you know, my reaction, I think like a lot of traditional IR people, when I first looked at these arguments was to say, well, you know, are you protesting too much? Isn't Roosevelt sort of just an upgrade, as it were? But on the other hand, the way that we talk about the other dimensions of the interwar period suggests that you're really right, that there's something quite distinctive about the Rooseveltian vision from the Wilsonian tradition, even if they both have progressive DNA, even if they both propose ultimately formally, broadly similar ways of organizing international politics, the UN, the League of Nations, a lot of the UN system is just appropriated from the old League system. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And clearly there are a lot of people who think that there are close analogies between the crisis of the interwar period and the contemporary crisis of liberalism. And I know that that's more or less your view, but I was wondering if you could maybe elaborate a bit on what's similar now and what's different now from, say, the 20s and 30s, the end of the 20s into the 30s, the period of time before the Second World War, where liberalism is breaking down, where conservative, authoritarian, and fascist governments are coming to power, and where liberalism does look like it's, even before the Second World War, potentially facing an extinction event, as you put it.
Yes. Well, let me make a couple points. The first one is kind of more of an IR point about the Rooseveltian vision of international order. Again, it's not just him. It's kind of a archetype of order and how it's different than Wilson, building on this kind of what comes first. The international order protects liberal democracy, or liberal democracy is leveraged for international order. Beyond that, the important shift that I kind of stumbled on as I was reading and thinking through these periods was that Wilson believed that enforcement, that states would abide by international law and rules of order based on the power of public opinion. And this is a very old idea that goes all the way back to the 19th century, Ricardo. There are different kind of earlier views that partly because liberal democracy elevates the voice of people and they can have some impact on what governments do. And when governments don't act right, so to speak, they violate agreed upon rules and laws that they are held to account. So there's a sense of enforcement through public opinion. By the 1930s, nobody in the liberal camp really believed that anymore. And Roosevelt actually, in a interesting cable he wrote to his ambassador in Berlin, who was a Wilsonian figure, said, you know, he explicitly said, you know, Wilson's view isn't applicable anymore. That how do we get countries to work together and abide by agreed upon rules and laws? His answer was that we build a kind of international order that has a kind of logic of conditionality, that to be in it was to gain certain benefits, trade and security, but also it required buying into a suite of responsibilities and obligations that would lead to cooperative behavior of the sort envisaged by the vision of order. Roosevelt had to, and his generation had to think, had to kind of build an order that had more stuff in it, not just, you know, rules for trade, but a kind of almost a way of life that would be sufficiently attractive that countries would be willing to surmount the barriers of entry by agreeing to abide by its precepts. And so you had to put more into the pot to make it more desirable. And so that was the sense of building a club, the free world, a kind of sense that to be in it was to take on obligations. And what kind of broke down with the end of the Cold War, when everybody was celebrating, the Berlin Wall came down, that sense of a club got lost. And the other kind of latent aspect of liberal internationalism, universalism, that everybody at some point, this is a work in progress part of the story, that everybody at some point will have an opportunity to join. It's easy to join, hard to overturn, as I've argued. And so the logic of conditionality kind of broke down, and countries could come in and cherry pick. It's kind of not like a club anymore. It's like a shopping mall where you can come in and or a public utility. You can hook up to what you want to and not what you don't want to. So that kind of sense of the fragmentation, and it does mean, if my argument is right, that there is something about barriers and exclusions that are important. And I might say that my good friend David Lake, in his co-authored introduction to the special issue of I.O., makes a point in passing about any stable order has to have borders. And a kind of the danger of liberal internationalism is partly the danger that it will succeed all too well, that it will become such a nub or hub or central locating space for international activity that everybody wants to connect, and all the kind of obligations and evolved understandings of how institutions operate and costs and benefits distributed get washed away, and we're just in a kind of a mess of a congeries of complicated and dysfunctional interactions.
Hey everybody, that's the end of the first part of my two-part interview with John Eikenberry. You can catch the second part in the next Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. Until then, be well.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of the Paranoid Styles catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again,